The Iowa caucuses may be just around the corner, but Joe Biden's setting his sights on Texas. Our conversation with the former vice president coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. People in one part of Houston desperate for answers to their questions about a cluster of cancer cases. Also, fully autonomous cars, not quite there, but self-driving semis coming soon to a highway near you. Plus, why a liquor once derided by some in Texas as desert moonshine has been making waves in Washington. All those stories and a whole lot more on the national news show of You Know Where. And we'll get started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 30th day of January 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. And just for the record, not that any public radio listener might get this wrong or anything, but it must be noted that the 2019 novel coronavirus is emphatically not related to a certain Mexican beer. Although Google Trends have reported a spike in searches for beer virus and corona beer virus, according to Austin TV station KVU, thankfully these searches appear most common in Connecticut, Oregon, and New York. On a more serious note, none of the four suspected coronavirus cases in Texas tested positive, though with 7,700 confirmed cases and 170 deaths, according to Chinese officials, the World Health Organization is expected to make a determination sometime today on whether to declare an international emergency. We also hear that some U.S. airlines are canceling flights to China. More in the Texas Roundup at the bottom of the hour. Notwithstanding unbelievable Google searches and such, we should note that more than a few of our listeners, as well as Texas political experts, did a double take on an election season story we reported yesterday. Results of the 2020 Texas Lyceum poll showing that in a hypothetical 2020 general election matchup, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders would come closest to beating Donald Trump in Texas, 50% to 47%.
So at first sight, That's surprising. You go, well, you know, Texas, it's a red state. But as I thought it through.
That's the voice of Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, director of civic engagement and lecturer at the LBJ School, UT Austin. After mulling it over a bit, she says she came to understand why the Lyceum poll might be accurate.
And here are two reasons to consider, David. The first is that Texas has a very young population and a predominantly Latino population, that those young folks that we're talking about are mainly Latino. And so that we do know that Bernie Sanders nationally is doing very well with Latino youth. So I think that's one component. The second part of it is one of the biggest frustrations for Democrats in Texas is the fact that we didn't see the Medicaid expansion. And if there's one thing that Bernie Sanders is known for is healthcare. We're near the bottom in terms of coverage rates. Healthcare is on the minds of us here in Texas.
Indeed, a major issue, but not the only issue here in Texas. And here's where it gets a little more interesting as you dig into this Lyceum poll. As you know, the Texas primary is March 3rd, and among potential primary voters here in Texas, former Vice President Joe Biden is leading in the Lone Star State. And though the former vice president has been crisscrossing Iowa in these last few days before the caucuses up there, he's clearly been thinking ahead to Super Tuesday and what it'll take to win the second biggest delegate prize of that day. And he joins us now. Vice President Biden, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Happy to be with you, man.
You know, we got a lot of listeners with questions, and I want to cut to the chase right now. Some fairly serious subject matter that they want me to bring up with you. Many Texans horrified by a pair of back-to-back mass shootings in El Paso and Midland, Odessa just a few months ago. And one of your former challengers, a native Texan named Beto O'Rourke, said, hell yes, we're going to take away your AR-15. What would President Joe Biden do?
I would ban the production of any new AR-15s. I'm the only guy that's ever beaten the NRA. I beat them twice. I was able to get rid of assault weapons as well as background checks and limit the number of bullets that can be held in a magazine or a clip. Who the devil needs to have a clip that can hold 200 or 50 or 70, you know, bullets in a clip? And so that's going to be a matter of first instance. Look, putting together, we're in a situation now that it's not just the NRA, it's the gun manufacturers. They, in fact, have the ability right now to make guns that, in fact, can only be, the trigger can only be pulled by someone who has a biometric marker on their hands to do it. But they won't do it because it's going to reduce the number of sales of guns. So this is a public health epidemic, in my view. And as president, I'm going to take on the NRA on this on these issues, and I'm going to beat them.
Well, do you believe in the idea of a mandatory gun buyback?
I believe in the idea of a gun buyback. When we did the legislation, what was said was that, in fact, if a weapon was deemed to be not able to be owned by an individual, it wasn't confiscated, but if it was ever used, had to be registered, you had it, and it was ever used, you were in a real problem. And there's been no real evidence that has, for example, machine guns and things like that.
So you like the gun buyback idea, but what about the mandatory aspect of it?
No, not the mandatory. I would make sure you either buy back or you register it.
Another issue on the short list for a lot of Texans, immigration and border security, and you've spoken out against the Trump administration's policy for sure. How closely would your policies track with those of the Obama administration?
It would track closer to the last year of our administration. Look, for me, it's all about families, about keeping families together, not separating families. And it's past time to fix the system. You know, we're ripping babies from mother's arms, putting them in cages. We have Muslim bans. He's not solving a border crisis. He just wants to gin it up for his base. And so I'm going to end the cruel asylum policies he has, where you have to sit in another country and squalor in order to be able to even apply for asylum. Finally, pass a comprehensive immigration reform, a path to citizenship. Recognize dreamers as Americans as they are. And we need smarter border technology and a streamlined, asylum system. And we need a lot more immigration judges. We're going to pay for that. And that's what we're going to do. And we're going to grow our economy by boosting opportunities for legal immigration. You know, keeping families, unification, and diversity as a cornerstone of our system is what we've been all about the whole time. So, I mean, we have to tackle. Another thing is, you may remember that I was able to put together a bipartisan initiative of almost $750 million to tackle the migration crisis at its root, investing in security and the prosperity of Central America. I spent hundreds of hours over time meeting with all those heads of state and saying, look, we're going to make sure that we'll help you with lighting your streets, with dealing with criminal gangs, with making sure schools are better, et cetera. But we're not going to give the money to you because we don't trust you. We're going to go right down there and we're going to build them ourselves with the local officials. So that's going to be, I'm going to propose a $1 billion a year plan to deal with the root cause of why people are leaving in the first place.
But Texas is home, I know you're aware, the largest number of uninsured people in the country. And I wonder, at this point, would you try to fix the Affordable Care Act or would you try something new?
My proposal in detail is to take the Affordable Care Act, restore all the cuts, add what we call a public option, a Medicare-like option, and further subsidize it so it's not as expensive to be able to buy in. That would cost a lot of money. It would cost about $700 billion more over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it would bring down drug prices, and I won't go into the whole thing with you, but it wouldn't cost, like Medicare for All, you know, $35 trillion or more. And it would be able to insure everyone. So anyone, for example, who is uninsured but eligible for Medicaid could automatically be insured in the Medicare program. It's added to my proposal. But here's the deal. It's an option. If you have private insurance you like, under Medicare for All, you have to give it up. You may have negotiated over years with your employer and you've given up wages to get it. Mm-hmm. And if you want to keep it, you should be able to keep it. 160 million people want to keep it. But if you don't, you can buy into and or if you don't have the money, be read into a Medicare for All proposal that is Medicare for all who want it.
You know, Mr. Vice President, thinking about the general election, poll after poll show that we're firmly in our political corners. I mean, people aren't crossing party lines or listening to the other side. Thinking about Texas politics right now, how do you try to win over Republicans? What's your pitch?
Well, my pitch is that Republican, look, once the Carney show goes through town the first time, and there's no pee under any of the three shells, next time it comes around, they kind of look up. I don't know any Republicans out there in Texas, many, who in fact think drug prices are fair. I don't know many Republicans out there who think that we're in a situation where we're doing what we need to be doing with highways and infrastructure. I don't know many Republicans out there who think, and I can go on. And I've been able, my whole career, I've been able to work with Republicans, get major things done. For example, after Trump was elected, but before he was sworn in, I put together a $9 billion program with Republicans and Democrats after the leadership of the Republican Party said, we're not going to consider anything in the United States Senate now until he's sworn in. And I was able to get 95 votes for the Cures Act, and I was able to get over 380 or 90 votes in the House. And what it was $1.9 billion. They renamed the Beau Biden Initiative for cancer research and depth research for cancer, and $7 billion for dealing with other research at NIH. There's things that people agree with. And by the way, and when you don't agree, you go out and you battle. But I do not believe the vast majority of Republicans in this country think that, for example, we shouldn't do something about the cost of drug prices. I don't think they think we shouldn't be doing something about the environment. I don't think I go down the line. That's Republican voters.
He's been crisscrossing the state of Iowa in advance of the upcoming caucuses next week. He is Vice President Joe Biden, one of the Democratic challengers for the U.S. presidency. And we expect to be talking to more of them, too, as the weeks go by. Joining us back in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. We're hearing from folks about our talk with Joe Biden, his stance on the border and immigration, gun violence, health insurance, and more. Those reactions later in the show. For now, several folks talking about the lay of the political land in Texas and that poll we discussed earlier as well. It found that while Joe Biden has the strongest support among registered potential Democratic primary voters here, when pollsters asked which candidate has the best chance of besting Trump, the majority said Bernie Sanders. On our Facebook page, Manuela Ornelas Armendariz says, if Sanders is the nominee, all the Republicans have to do is say socialist and we're doomed. Meanwhile, Jose Fonseca says this about the tight Democratic primary in Texas. He says, maybe more and more people are feeling disenfranchised by Wall Street. What good is a booming stock market when you can't afford your medical bills and student loans? Middle class is shrinking. Where is the windfall from the top? Just some of the reactions we're seeing out there, David, and I'll be back with more later on in the broadcast.
Good question here. Where's your reaction? We'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. You just reach out to us on your social media platform of choice. Look up Texas Standard, because you know Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He's going to be joining us once again here in the studio in about 35 minutes with more comments from across the Lone Star State. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. How much do experts know about the chemicals in those consumer products under your kitchen sink or in the garage? Only about 20%, according to a multi-year study by San Antonio's Southwest Research Institute. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports on the attempt to determine what's in the other 80%.
We don't know what chemicals are in many things, and we don't have an efficient way of figuring it out. Most chemical tests are targeted. So say you want to know how much caffeine's in a coffee bean. They get back a bunch of data. So for my example, it'll be an audio form, and it's noise. But because they know what they're targeting, they can start to eliminate or turn down the volume on some of the frequencies until they find exactly what they're looking for. But if we wanted to know all the chemicals that were in that coffee bean or anything else, that means you'd have to take in all of the data and analyze it. And right now that process is tedious and long, but necessary, because we don't even know what's in most things. Take a common deodorant.
We have actually looked at products like deodorant before, and it is not unusual to find 500 to 1,000 individual chemicals in that product that only has 20 to 30 ingredients listed.
That's Dr. Kristen Favela, She and other Southwest research scientists, from space science to machine learning, have helped create Floodlight, a tool that automates much of the baseline analysis, speeding up these non-targeted tests with high degrees of accuracy and without any human interaction. With the Floodlight software, they can analyze consumer products for quality assurance, fingerprint oil so that spills are easier to attribute, and even document the toxins in everyday life, from your personal care products to your carpet to your car seat.
All the plastics, all the cups that we drink from, all of those have chemicals in them. And in order to know which chemicals are potentially harmful, we first need to know what's there.
With Floodlight, they hope they can at least start to do that. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Once upon a time, some Texans considered it the cheap stuff, like a desert moonshine only roughnecks would drink. But in a sign of the times, there he was, Senator John Cornyn, in a committee chamber on Capitol Hill, interrupting a review of a complex trade deal to recommend that his colleagues try the stuff for themselves. The stuff is a spirit called Sotol or Sotol. And Tom Benning in the Washington Bureau of the Dallas Morning News has been trying to distill its newfound significance politically, economically, and culturally. Tom, that's some pretty heady liquor you're talking about. You ever tried Sotol?
I have indeed, as part of my process in reporting the story, it seemed like a necessary activity. So I did get to taste some, and I can agree with the senator's recommendation that folks, if they're interested in that kind of thing, will likely enjoy it.
A little like what I've heard it described as a little like mezcal. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that kind of relates to the plants themselves being kind of like second cousins, a similar type process and, you know, creating the liquor. But yeah, similar taste, but not quite exactly the same.
Why exactly was Senator John Cornyn making the case for trying this stuff out before his Senate colleagues?
So it goes to a small part of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the revamp of NAFTA that President Donald Trump signed yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that covers a whole host of issues. But as part of it, there was a side letter between the U.S. and Mexico where it was kind of a trade-off. Each country agreed to consider recognizing products from the other country as either distinctly Mexican or distinctly American. So Mexico said, we'll consider classifying American rye whiskey as distinctly American.
Mm-hmm.
In turn, the U.S. said, we'll consider doing that for three spirits from Mexico, one of them being Sotol. And that, while it may sound like not that big of a deal, those classifications can have a huge impact in the sense of, think of champagne or tequila or any of these other products that can only be called that if they're produced in that certain area under certain conditions. So U.S. producers, the small number of them, small and growing, would not be able to sell a product called Sotol.
So this plant, which is found in parts of northern Mexico, New Mexico, West Texas, if you're a distiller and you're using this plant for that, normally you would market it as Sotol, but in fact, under terms of this agreement, were it to go forward, you couldn't call it Sotol if you were distilling it and trying to market it in the United States.
Correct. So since 2004, Mexico has enforced what's called a denomination of origin, saying basically that Sotol can only be called Sotol, or it can only truly be that spirit if it's produced in Chihuahua and two other Mexican states.
Okay.
Chihuahua is the huge region that kind of borders a big chunk of the U.S., the Texas-Mexico border. And if the U.S. were to recognize that denomination of origin, which currently has no legal weight in the U.S., then the folks out at Desert Door Distillery, for instance, in Driftwood, would no longer be able to produce a product that they are currently calling Sotol. They wouldn't be able to sell it. They wouldn't be able to get the label to say this is Sotol.
Well, you talk about this distillery there in Central Texas. How big of a market is there for this Sotol? Is it sizable?
It's certainly still on the obscure side. It's not nearly as well known or as popular as other spirits. One brand manager estimated to me that if you look at the amount of exports from Mexico to the U.S. of Sotol compared to tequila, it's like a fraction of a percent. But nevertheless, I mean, we continue to see this boom in kind of craft artisanal spirits. People are interested in trying out new things. And so there's potentially a big industry here. And that's kind of maybe gets to the heart of the issue of while there has been a tradition of producing this spirit on both sides of the border dating back, you know, centuries, indigenous groups have been doing this in the Chihuahuan Desert long before there was a U.S.-Mexico border. That's why these Mexican producers are pushing for this designation. They see it as an opportunity not only to protect their culture, but as perhaps a way to provide some economic empowerment to people who have been doing this for a long time.
Very briefly, where does that stand now? Has Mexico won this round or what?
What all the, you know, Senator John Cornyn was able to do, because this trade deal, you know, you can't really change it at the last second, was say get a commitment that all the U.S. has agreed to do is consider a review process. They've not agreed to any particular outcome. So we're kind of still, it's going to be a waiting game. And obviously the status quo tends to win out in Washington, no matter the topic. So we'll have to see as this, you know, the president just signed the USMCA. Now we'll continue to watch it and see how this review process goes. So it could end up, though, be a result that relies on producers on both sides of the border maybe coming together and seeing if there's some kind of compromise or agreement that could satisfy folks on both sides.
Tom Benning, Washington, D.C.-based reporter for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to his latest at TexasStandard.org. Tom, good to talk with you again, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, you know what's next, right? Take a look at that clock. Yeah, we got the Texas Roundup just around the corner. That's right. It's a roundup of the news across the Lone Star State, so stick around for it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The teacher retirement system of Texas is facing pushback over its impending move to a costly office in downtown Austin. The Austin American-Statesman reports the state agency is slated to pay at least $326,000 per month. State Representative Tony Tenderholt is a Republican from Arlington and one of the lawmakers raising concerns about the expense.
These teachers are literally changing our communities in a positive way. And when they retire, it's incumbent upon us to do the right things for them, and this just isn't right.
TRS manages retirement benefits for 1.6 million current and former teachers and school employees. The Texas School for the Deaf is launching two apps to help implement a new state law aimed at preventing school violence. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
The Smart Button Instant Panic Button app is exclusively for School for the Deaf employees. Superintendent Claire Bugin says it will especially be helpful in emergency situations with so many people spread across their 67-acre campus.
We have a lot of deaf people, and of course they will use the email and the texting button to communicate.
There's also anonymous alerts, an app allowing students to report different situations anonymously, from active shooters to a mental health crisis.
We customized it when it was, say, a depression or a self-harm threat. It went immediately to a counselor.
Superintendent Bugin hopes to have everyone using the apps by the end of next month. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
The nonprofit Battleship Texas Foundation is seeking proposals to relocate the only remaining dreadnought to serve in World War I and World War II. The USS Texas is currently at the San Jacinto Battleground State Historic Site, which does not draw enough visitors to cover the cost of maintaining the vessel. Texas Standard's Michael Marks has more.
So the foundation is going to accept proposals until March 13th. It will announce three finalists around the second week of April and then a winner on April 30th. Still unclear who the bidders might be. The city of Baytown will almost certainly bid. The city of Galveston will not. Earlier this week, the city's park board passed on submitting a bid. Otherwise, it's pretty much up in the air.
And the Texas legislature last year allocated $35 million to repair the battleship. Next month, American Airlines will suspend its flights between Los Angeles and Beijing, as well as Shanghai, due to the outbreak of the coronavirus in China. The Fort Worth-based carrier says demand has dropped significantly. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron Adler, Clough & Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas. Protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. Coming soon to a Texas highway near you, self-driving semis. So reports Peter Holly, senior editor for Texas Monthly. The story titled Waymo's Autonomous Trucks Are Rolling Into Texas and Bringing a Debate About Jobs and Safety with Them. Peter, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit more about Waymo. This is the company launching all these self-driving trucks?
That's right. Waymo is a subsidiary of Alphabet, or Google. Mm-hmm. They've been testing autonomous vehicles all over the country for much of the past decade, primarily, though, in Arizona. That's where you're going to see most of their vehicles driving around the streets without drivers.
So why are they coming to Texas?
They're coming to Texas because Texas has a really high freight volume. They're in the process of deploying big rigs that are self-driving as well. And so Texas is an attractive spot, both because of the freight volume, but also because of the fact that it has a great climate. Not a lot of snow, not a lot of cold temperatures.
I thought you were going to say not a lot of regulation either, because I would think that that might be an issue here when it comes to self-driving trucks.
That's true. Texas appears to be a pretty friendly regulatory environment. The regulations are still being developed, and that's true all over the country. So Waymo is picking states where they think that they can actually do some substantial testing of their autonomous vehicles.
I say with tongue slightly in cheek that you could probably do this on I-10 without too many troubles, especially between San Antonio and El Paso. But don't they have to run this by DPS or something? I mean, is there not a risk when you're on increasingly crowded highways, you have an autonomous truck, a semi, no less?
Well, you know, I think that's a debate that is now beginning to unfold. And it's interesting that Waymo's already here because the public really hasn't caught up. There haven't been wrecks associated with their autonomous vehicles technology, but there have been wrecks associated with autonomous vehicles around the country and other drivers not really being ready for them. Mm-hmm. So this debate is now unfolding. We're not really sure what it's going to look like, but it could have an impact and it could be potentially dangerous.
Safety is just part of the story, though, right? I mean, because there are plenty of truck drivers who, I mean, if this picks up steam, could lose their jobs.
And once again, that's also a debate. You have one side of the coin saying that there's going to be significant job losses over the next 10 years. On the other hand, you have people who are promoting AVs who feel like they'll be able to incorporate drivers into the cab sort of as someone who oversees the truck while it's driving. So this is still a big debate, and there's immediately pretty fierce voices on both sides.
Is there a timeline here, or are they already rolling across the Lone Star State?
Some of their vehicles arrived last week to initially map the highways between, as you mentioned, El Paso, Houston, and Dallas. But the actual big rigs, the 18-wheelers, they haven't arrived yet, and they're not giving us a timeline. So I'm guessing it's going to happen in the next few months. But it's going to require them to map the highways with their initial minivans.
Since this is bleeding edge technology, I would think that there is a higher than normal price associated with getting your freight moved about by an autonomous vehicle.
You know, I actually don't know how much it's going to cost folks. And initially, they're not going to have freight on the vehicles. The big rigs are rolling in to be tested, so it's still more of a testing scenario. Mm-hmm. Long term, the trucking companies, they're looking forward to this because they think it is going to lower costs.
How quickly is this technology advancing, though? I mean, because I think that there are some people who we've been hearing about autonomous vehicles for some time, and it's been sort of slow to peak out in consumer cars, for example. I mean, you do have some sort of quasi self-driving vehicles out there now, but the idea of a semi being fully autonomous, I don't know, it still seems quite futuristic.
It does seem futuristic, but if you look at some news reports from recent years, self-driving semis have already made deliveries in Arizona and other places. This is already workable technology. And if you go to Phoenix, where Waymo does most of its business, you already have people riding in their cabs all over town without drivers. So this is here. The question is, how is it going to impact a place like Texas?
Have you heard anybody say that Texas now needs to get serious about coming up with a regulatory scheme, or is that also in the future?
The Teamsters, who represent a lot of truck drivers in the state, that's what they're talking to the state legislature about right now. They're in the early stages of that talk. There isn't a strong regulatory framework, it appears, and that's going to be a huge source of debate over the next few months, I would guess.
Very interesting stuff. We've been talking about Waymo, the company that's launching a whole new fleet of self-driving trucks. And by trucks, we're talking semis across the Lone Star State. You can read all about it at Texas Monthly, where Peter Holly is a senior editor. Peter, thanks so much for getting us up to speed.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Marika Flatt, travel editor with Texas Lifestyle Magazine, here with your weekend trip tip. Abilene has experienced a renaissance in recent years. The galleries, shops, restaurants, and watering holes in the city's center are bustling. New construction bangs and hums, bringing more craft breweries, apartments, a distillery, lofts, and good places to eat. The project that launched Abilene's rehabilitation was the gorgeous 1987 restoration of the glamorous Paramount Theater. Built in 1930, the theater's auditorium replicates a Spanish Moorish courtyard at night. Locals and visitors enjoy a busy slate of events there. Movies, local theater productions, opera, concerts, ballet, and traveling productions. The cornerstone of the cultural district is the Grace Museum. Once a hotel for railroad travelers, the four-story building now serves as an art, history, and children's museum. One reason for continued optimism is the construction of a full-service convention hotel. A 206-room DoubleTree by Hilton, adjacent to the city's convention center and cultural district, is projected to open at the end of 2021. The hotel is a homecoming for the Hilton brand. Just a few blocks away is where it was born. In the 1920s, a young hotelier named Conrad Hilton opened a 260-room Hilton Hotel, the second of what he called three of Texas's finest moderately priced hotels. The building still houses a gorgeous ballroom and apartments. Abilene was listed as number 14 among U.S. cities where millennials chose to move in 2019. The newcomers have brought ingenuity and an entrepreneurial spirit with them. The local Chamber of Commerce operates a dynamic group of young professionals, 570 members strong, while an energetic and collaborative downtown association plots holiday decorating, shopping days, and festivals. Just past the historic site of a real Old West shootout, you'll find the Frontier Texas Museum and Visitor Center. It gives an overview of the region's early inhabitants. The outside architecture echoes the ruins of the U.S. Army forts that dot the plains, but the inside is all high-tech. Life-sized, holographic images tell tales curated by Texas historians who crafted scripts that use the characters' own words. Other downtown venues include the National Center for Children's Illustrated Literature, a place where adults and children can celebrate the original artwork produced for favorite storybooks. The Children's Art and Literacy Festival each June celebrates Abilene's Storybook Capital of America trademark. It's a designation reflected in the city's more than 24 whimsical public sculptures. Kids can download an app and hunt for the statues, and they're ready-made for family photos. The historic properties north of the railroad tracks, as well as the blossoming soda district just south, house a myriad of drinking and dining options. These include wood stove, fired pizza, upscale comfort food, pubs, delis, cocktails, or wine among the silos of an old mill. The city was also recently certified by the Texas Music Office as a music-friendly community, and it is nurturing a lively scene for performing artists. And that's music to our ears. That's your weekend trip tip. I'm Marika Flatt for the Texas Standard.
I'm going to Abilene. I don't know about y'all. Come with us. Marika Flatt is travel editor for Texas Lifestyle Magazine. You can check out more of her weekend trip tips at texasstandard.org. You probably know or suspect that Facebook tracks you even when you're using other sites around the internet. Sure enough, those Facebook ads that match your shopping or political preferences are no accident, but a new feature called Off Facebook promises to show you how the social network tracks you and to give you control over that tracking. But does it really do all that? Texas expert and tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to tell us what Off Facebook actually does for users. Hey there, Omar.
Hey, David. How are you?
Texas tech expert. You can't say that because it sounds like you're talking about a college. So it's a tech expert from Texas.
I love my Texas.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about what kinds of internet activity Facebook actually tracks first off, if we can.
Yeah, well, we know that Facebook has its hands in a lot of different places, that it's tracking you even when you are not on Facebook, even when you are not a Facebook user, which is kind of scary. And what they did was they announced last fall that they were going to give users a tool to be able to see that data, to see what websites, what apps are tracking you and giving data to Facebook about you. So the tool now is just rolling out. You can get to it on your mobile or your desktop Facebook. I'm looking at mine right now. And you ready for a shot?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm connected to 656 apps and websites that have shared my activity with Facebook.
Wow. That's crazy.
That's just me. One
that
person.
Is incredible.
And I'm looking at the list right now. I mean, it's a lot. I mean, it's practically every website I've ever been to.
But here's the good news, Omar. All you have to do is click off Facebook and all of it goes away. Right?
Oh, yeah. It's so easy. Yeah. It'll totally work. Mm-hmm. No, the problem is even if you opt to clear your history and to tell Facebook, I don't want this stuff to happen anymore. First of all, it takes 48 hours for that to even go through. So it's still going to be collecting information for you for the next 48 hours. And it doesn't really sever the relationship between advertisers or websites and Facebook. It just kind of keeps you apart from it. They're still going to collect that data. They're still going to be getting information about you, whether you even have a Facebook account or not. So, I mean, I've seen some tech blogs look at this and kind of play around with it and say, this doesn't do anything. This gives you some information, but it doesn't really prevent the things that are scary about all of this.
Well, certainly not if you're not even on Facebook and it's continuing to track you. But if you are, if you are on Facebook and you want to give it a go anyway, how would you find these new settings? And in fact, are they available right now?
Yeah, I'm looking at my desktop one. If you go into settings, that little tab on the top right of your screen, under settings, there's a thing called your Facebook information. If you click on that, it will say off Facebook activity. And when you go into that, it gives you all the options to kind of see all of the activity, to clear your history, supposedly, and to manage your off Facebook activity. On mobile, it's even easier. You just go into your settings and it should be one of the main options under privacy and security.
Okay, so I know that a lot of people don't trust Facebook these days, especially when it announces initiatives to protect people's privacy or to correct some previous misstep. I'm wondering if that skepticism has had any impact on Facebook's bottom line. Clearly, they're trying to create the impression that they're going to be good citizens. It sounds that way to me with this off Facebook feature. But has it hurt them in the pocket?
It hasn't, as far as users and growth. I mean, they're still making truckloads and truckloads of money on on ads, ad money. But what it has done is it has opened them up to some lawsuits, to some things where they're getting hit in the pocket that way. They just settled a $550 million lawsuit in Illinois over facial recognition,
wow,
which is becoming kind of a hot button issue in a lot of legislatures. We're seeing a lot of activity in new laws dealing with facial recognition, kind of taking after a lot of laws in Europe.
Would you recommend people go to the trouble of clicking off Facebook if it's not really going to make much of a difference? What do you say, Omar?
I think everyone should at least take a look at it because it's very eye-opening. It tells you how many interactions with each app or website you have. I mean, I'm looking at HEB and I have 20 plus interactions with HEB. I shop there a whole lot and use their app and their website. So even if it's not dangerous information, at least you know how many times Facebook is interacting with these apps and what data is being shared.
Omar Gayaga talks tech over at TechMinuteTexas.com, and he talks with us every week about this time. Omar, thanks a lot.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
Coming up on 49 Minutes Past the Hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
Got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In one of Houston's oldest neighborhoods, residents are being diagnosed with cancer at an alarming rate, and the community is calling for help. Last week, U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee and environmental activist Aaron Brockovich spoke in front of a packed house at Wheatley High School's auditorium in Houston's Fifth Ward. It was in that neighborhood that the Texas Department of State Health Services last year discovered elevated cancer rates. Houston Health Department's Chief Environmental Science Officer Lauren Hopkins called the situation, quoting here, "the worst example of environmental justice I have ever seen," close quote. Davis Land has been following this story. He's senior news producer at Houston Public Media. Davis, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David.
So these findings actually go back to August. Where does this story begin?
Well, it begins years ago. You know, they've known kind of that these sites, or this particular rail yard and some sites nearby, had caused creosote contamination for years, going back to the beginning of the 1900s. But it's only this in these past few months that the state has confirmed that there are, in fact, higher cancer rates in the neighborhoods adjacent to them.
Last week, U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee and I mentioned, along with Aaron Brockovich, held this well-attended town hall in Houston. They were calling for action on this contamination, but action from whom exactly? I mean, who is it that is responsible for this contamination?
You know, that's a hard thing to pin down. You know, when the TCEQ, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, requests a cancer cluster survey like this, they can't, when the state health department goes to do them, they can't exactly point to a cause. That's a very difficult thing there is to prove. But people have been calling on the EPA to step in and designate this a Superfund site. I know Sheila Jackson Lee's office was circulating a petition on that, as well as the city health department has been out there surveying the community, and the county health department says they'll be surveying the community as well.
Union Pacific is involved? How so?
Yeah, so they bought the site from a different company years ago, and after creosote operations there had ceased. And so now they're continuing to do monitoring. They're trying to renew their permit with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. Of course, a lot of this is getting in the way of that as residents demand, you know, more sampling. Some residents want to be moved out of the area while this is, you know, continuing to be mitigated and cleaned up. And in general, it's, you know, it's a hard situation for people to be in because it's not kind of clear what to do, as a lot of people have already gotten the cancer. And it's kind of been said and done in that sense.
You've also heard, as you mentioned, from people living in that neighborhood voicing concerns. This is a resident named Lisa Glenn.
I mean, how do all these people die of cancer? And so far, everybody is still dying in the neighborhood. So what I want to know, what are they planning on doing? Waiting till the rest of us die?
So her question basically is, what are officials planning to do? And what answers have you heard, Davis?
Well, a lot of people still want something done here, obviously. You know, I mentioned Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee's office circulating that petition to request a Superfund cleanup site in the area from the EPA. You know, other federal agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Department of Transportation are talking about federal grants and programs that people can apply for to seek relief. But there's not really a clear answer as to what people can look forward to here and you know, have have the situation resolved.
But if we're talking about people who have already contracted cancer, are there lawsuits? What is the status currently?
You know, there are community groups that are out speaking out on this issue and demanding action from the government and local officials. I personally haven't seen any lawsuits that have been filed on behalf of them.
Davis Land is senior news producer for Houston Public Media. Davis, keep us posted.
Sure thing. Will do.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. You know what I got open on my home screen here?
What you got there, David?
I got some New York Times action going on.
Oh, yeah.
And interesting thing, 7 minutes ago, the Times says Trump could win a bipartisan acquittal.
Hmm.
A bipartisan acquittal. Apparently, the Times and others are saying that the GOP is driving the trial right now in the U.S. Senate toward a rapid end. Of course, this is one of the many stories that NPR continues to follow, and you can
definitely
probably keep up
so.
With right here on this very station.
I know, yeah, this ongoing question of whether or not witnesses will be called, whether or not we'll hear from John Bolton. So, yeah, stay tuned for that. Well, speaking of the White House, one person angling to be its next occupant, Joe Biden, appeared on the program today, hearing from our friends and listeners about the vice president's appearance on her show. Laura Young is enthusiastic via Facebook. She says, "Nice get this morning to open the show. We got an email about Biden from listener James White regarding one of the topics he picked up there. He says, I don't like his Second Amendment restrictions." This was in reference to this question about what to do about stemming the tide of gun violence, specifically here in Texas, as we've had mass shootings. More discussion as well about that Texas Lyceum poll we were talking about. This was that poll showing a slight edge for Biden over Bernie Sanders among registered potential Democratic primary voters in Texas. But it also found those respondents thought Sanders was the best candidate against Trump in the general. Via Twitter, Vladimir Mehrman, he says that considering Bernie Sanders won over the Fox News town hall and got a standing ovation, surely he can win over Texas, referring there to a town hall from last year. Another listener emails to note that the leads in this poll, David, are very small and within the margin of error.
True.
So something to definitely keep in mind there. And I think I saw a statement from another friend of ours on Facebook who said, you know, after 2016, I kind of feel like polls are meaningless because
there is a whole lot of
disagreement.
Yeah, we should do sort of an existential conversation about the future of polls, certainly in this election year. You know, just to lift the curtain a little bit on our conversation with Joe Biden, I mean, after we were done, some of the stuff that we didn't include in the broadcast, I asked him about there's these reports that he might be thinking of bringing Michelle Obama on as a vice presidential. And he was kidding, I think. But anyway, I asked him about it. And he sort of got a little bit, you know, testy. He was like, no, wait a minute. I was just kidding. It was just someone asking me
just
about
riffing.
Yeah, just riffing. And I said, well, I understood. I was just having a little fun with you. And I said, so who are you looking for? He said, I'm looking for someone, you know, diversity, a person of color.
Yeah, we've been hearing whispers about Kamala Harris.
Yeah, a lot of that kind of stuff. And I said, so you found somebody? And he goes, no, are you available? And so I said to him, "No, actually, actually, I have not declared my party affiliation." And then he came back without missing a beat. He bounced back and said, "Well, neither has Bernie."
There we go.
Yeah. See, he's
and that's really borne out. You know, we have seen an increase in Sanders numbers here in Texas, but it's also borne out what I'm seeing in the Texas Standard, you know, comments on our Facebook page. People saying, you know, hey, he caucuses with the Democrats, but he is, you know, technically an independent. You know, another story that folks are keeping an eye on: several Texas airports to begin screening travelers for that form of coronavirus.
Yeah, Houston.
Houston, Dallas, and the El Paso airports. Many applauding the news. However, on our Facebook page, Ivan Parizato, he says, can y'all say media panic? So this discussion back and forth over how much focus on this sort of stuff is too much focus.
Yeah. One other quick thing. You know, we're sort of truck capital of the world. The Hummer's coming back.
Oh, yeah.
Just reading
but did it
Hummer's
ever really go away here in Texas?
I think it's going to be an electric vehicle is my understanding. We've been covering a lot of stuff here on The Standard. News continues over at TexasStandard.org, and we're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.